Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, for the United States, the leading cause of death between 1 and 45 is not an infectious problem. It's unintentional injury. Many of us have not recognized dramatic changes that have happened in the last 30 or 40 years in the United States. And these unintentional injuries are causing somewhere in the neighborhood of about 120,000 deaths, and that includes for all age groups. But for the majority of the world's population, infections continue to remain a very important and often leading killer. Malaria, for example, causes 200 million infections a year, and about 660,000 people die. The Global Fund is an organization that tries to fight against three of these prominent infections: HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Today's guests are Dr. Joanne Carter. She's joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., where she's Executive Director of Results. This is a grassroots advocacy organization trying to generate public and political will to help organizations like the Global Fund fight these infections. And then in the studio today is a local attorney, Roger Hudson, who is the group leader for Results in Anchorage. I want to say thanks very much for taking the time to both of you. Appreciate to have you here.
Thank you very much for making the time available.
All right.
Great to be on.
Joanne, tell us a little bit about Results. Since you're the executive director, let's bring our listeners up to date about your organization and what you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. And Results is a grassroots advocacy organization, as you said, that works to address the root causes of poverty. So that we're looking at what are the underlying fundamental causes of poverty in the world that if we address them, we could actually not only reduce but actually end severe poverty in the world. That includes things like health care to prevent and treat the biggest killer diseases of children and adults, the kind of things you were just talking about, ensuring that every kid in the world can actually go to school and learn, even the poorest kids, the orphans, and that all poor families, especially women in those families, have access to economic opportunity to help move themselves out of poverty. So that's really our mission, but we have a dual mission, and part of that is to also, as an advocacy organization, empower ordinary folks around the U.S. and in other countries to actually be advocates for these things. So while we work on these issues, we don't directly vaccinate kids. We don't build schools. We don't give small loans to very poor women to start businesses. But we actually help ensure that our government takes modest amount of money and invests them in things that really work. And that's really what our advocacy is all about. We're in 100 U.S. cities, including in Anchorage and in Sitka, and in 10 other countries on 5 continents, doing this kind of advocacy to actually ensure that we leverage smart government spending to have the biggest impact we can have with modest amounts of money to end poverty.
Very good. Let me ask a little bit more about you. I'm interested. I know a little bit from reading your CV, but what is your experience that brought you to this particular job exactly as executive director? Because clearly your past experiences have influenced your drive and initiative and interest in this particular area.
I mean, I would say it's really two pieces. One is actually having the opportunity to spend time in places like India, in various parts of Africa, in Bangladesh, and to actually get to see not only the problems, but the fact that there are, in many cases, really effective and often inexpensive, easy to implement solutions if we knew about them and if we were putting some attention behind them. So part of it is the impetus to just see what was possible. And then the other part of my own story is that I used to be a veterinarian. I was practicing, doing other work, and I actually found Results myself as a volunteer over 20 years ago. And even though I had been involved in policy work and political work for many years, I really had no idea the impact that ordinary folks can have on the political process beyond voting. That voting is not the end point, it's just the beginning point, and that folks, if they get support to be educated on these issues, can have a huge influence in what Congress decides to do on these issues, in what the media reports on these issues. So that kind of combination was the impetus for me to leave the other work I was doing, move down to Washington, and start working for Results over 20 years ago.
Okay. And Roger, same question to you. What brought you to Results?
Well, I'm here to represent that ordinary person. That's me. But I got exposed to Results really early after its founding, because the guy who decided to take on the mission originally, a guy named Sam Daly Harris, he had gotten involved in a group called the Hunger Project back in the late 70s, and he'd done some study on nutrition around the world and lack of access to food for people. And what was identified in the studies that were done, National Science Foundation and others, was that what was missing was political will. So he decided he was going to take on founding an organization that was going to help people exercise their citizenship rights and contribute to the creation of political will to handle some of our global problems that weren't receiving the attention that they needed to. I always think of a congressman being elected, and most of them go to D.C. with very little foreign travel, if any, very little awareness of what's going on in the developing world. And they're expected to be knowledgeable and make wise decisions about everything under the sun. But they need lobbyists. Lobbyists have kind of a bad name, but all lobbyists aren't self-interested. They're not all high-paid guys working for some economic interest group or something. Some lobbyists are just people that want to make sure that their government is reflecting their own values. And I found that being a lobbyist for Results as a volunteer is incredibly rewarding, and it makes me feel like I'm making a difference in the world, that I have found no other way where I feel like I can have the same amount of impact, because our government spends a whole lot of our tax dollars. That's sort of not voluntary on our part to give them our money, but what they do with it, we're blessed enough to live in a democracy where we're supposed to be able to tell them what we think the priorities ought to be. So I've fallen in love with this organization, and I feel incredibly blessed to have found it and have been able to participate with people all around the country and all around the world in trying to help our fellow man and make this a better world by using the leverage that we have as citizens to influence what our government's priorities are.
Joanne, the Results organization is described as an organization that's out to try to end the root causes of poverty globally. And perhaps it would be worthwhile to try to help our listeners understand the connection between poverty and illness, and particularly in this case, infectious diseases, and specifically, if you wanted to, but not necessarily HIV, AIDS, and tuberculosis, and malaria. How are those two interlinked? Why would somebody interested in poverty want to attack infectious disease?
It's a great and really, really important question. I think there's two pieces to that. One is that, often the poorest people in this country and in the world are the ones that are most affected by infectious diseases. So malaria in particular, for example, is a big killer of young children and pregnant women in Africa especially. And so many people get malaria and get ill, but the people that most commonly die are young kids under five and pregnant women. And it's really often the kids clustered in the poorest communities and the poorest families. That's also true of, with HIV. It's also true of other big killers of kids like diarrhea and pneumonia. But these diseases are not just consequences of poverty. They're really causes. And I think that's hugely important. So if you look at AIDS, if you look at tuberculosis, they particularly impact young adults. So people from adolescence to their mid-40s is the biggest cluster of where you're going to see people mostly affected. And what these diseases do is they take take people who are already in very difficult, fragile situations and push them right over the edge. So they get sick and they can't work. They spend what little money they have to try to get treatment. Or a parent or a breadwinner dies, and they leave literally, you know, in this world, millions of kids orphaned. And then we have this ongoing generational impact of these diseases actually causing poverty and then keeping those families and their kids for generations locked into poverty. You know, kids get pulled out of school because they then need to take care of sick parents and don't get to go to school. So it's a huge, huge driver. One of the most influential experiences I ever had was in Bangladesh, working with one of the biggest institutions that makes tiny loans to very poor women to start their own businesses to help them move out of poverty, you know, buying a chicken and selling the eggs, you know, buying a mortar and pestle so they can grind spices and sell them, these really tiny businesses. And this organization in Bangladesh had been trying for years to get some money to work on the issue of tuberculosis because they found the biggest reason that their borrowers, these poor women, ended up not being able to pay back their loans. Most did, but the ones that couldn't, the biggest reason was they got sick with tuberculosis. Hmm. So a huge driver of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners real quickly, I failed to do that at the beginning. If you have questions or comments about today's program, our local number is 550-8433. It's 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. My guests are Dr. Joanne Carter. She's Executive Director of Results. And Roger Hudson, who's an attorney and the local group leader for Results here in Anchorage. Results is a grassroots advocacy organization working on addressing the causes of poverty globally. And as we've just heard Dr. Carter discuss, infectious diseases are a prime cause of persistent for poverty and persistent poverty. So, Joanne, it's almost like that when you're struggling to be healthy, it's hard to be economically successful, if I can make it too simple.
No, well said. I mean, you know, I think, again, people that are sick can't work. People that are sick, you know, can't sometimes pay fees to send their kids to school, which is still needed in many places in the world. So you just keep repeating that cycle. You know, you mentioned early on several hundred million cases of malaria every year. And that those cases mean that people are often too sick to work for that period of time. So even if you don't die, even if you aren't completely debilitated, you're losing income, your economy is being affected. But it has some really dire effects when you're looking at HIV/AIDS or tuberculosis for people that don't get treatment.
This is a question I struggled over when to ask, and I think I'm going to go ahead and ask it now. So one of the issues was, what's the connection between poverty and infectious disease? The next question is, why should we care? Why should developed countries, why should the richer nations of the world care about trying to control poverty in the rest of the world and particularly infectious disease? What's the rationale for that?
Maybe I can start, and Roger, you can jump in. But
sure.
I think a couple of things. I mean, one, I think that we have to really grasp, which is that we are, and it may not seem the most obvious one, but we are really at this pivotal moment when we are looking at some of the biggest killers on the planet, tuberculosis and malaria, that have been with us for literally tens of thousands of years, you know, or thousands, certainly since recorded history, and AIDS, which is really the sort of black plague of the 20th century. We're at a moment when we're talking now not just about fighting these diseases, but actually defeating them, ending them as public health problems in the next 10 to 15 years. You know, not that that's going to be easy, but we are really halfway there or more. And if we continue to invest and build on what we've done, we really have the chance to eliminate these diseases as public health problems. And nobody I think, even imagined that that was possible even 10 years ago. We're at this tipping point. So in some ways, this is a case where, you know, it's the moral thing to do, and we are at a tipping point. But I would say it's also a case where the moral and the right thing to do is also the smart thing to do. Because these diseases are global health risks. You know, tuberculosis is an airborne disease. You get it from people coughing. You know, it's not necessarily caught as easily as the flu, but it is transmitted by as an airborne infection. And nobody, like everyone, is at risk. You know, you're at risk if you breathe. And so if we don't actually take care of these diseases in all of the places that they're happening, then we're all at risk. And I would also say, you know, we saw just a decade ago that AIDS and tuberculosis were literally destabilizing whole countries and societies in Africa. And had we and, you know, other countries not helped intervene to scale up treatment, literally countries were almost falling apart economically and socially, that to a point where you had millions of orphans. You had to train two teachers for, you know, every classroom because people were dying so fast. People were going to funerals every day. So the kind of destabilizing effects of these diseases on whole economies and countries, the global health risk, but also on the really positive side, this incredible moment that we're at where we could really defeat these diseases, you know, again, with, by comparison to other things, really modest investments.
I'll throw in a couple of... Well, first, I'll second the humanitarian issue because I was back in D.C. attending the Results International Conference in summer of 12, and it happened to coincide with the Global AIDS Conference. And I went down to the public exhibit hall of the conference, and they had a big screen up showing the proceedings of the conference. And for some reason, it really grabbed me. There was a dignified African woman from Nigeria and her mother that were invited to come up, and they just spoke from the heart their appreciation of the fact the woman that her life had been saved so that she could care for and raise her family, and the daughter, the fact that she hadn't been made an orphan, and they just said thank you. And for some reason that it was just the right moment and the right expression, and I never felt more proud of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen things all around the world that our government has done, the CIA or the military or whatever, or big business, that I'm not necessarily fully in alignment with what our impact on the world has been. But the United States leadership on dealing with these infectious disease issues has really made me proud to be an American. And it's really, I think, created a lot of goodwill around the world for us. In the last couple of years, I've met several people from Africa. Joyce Kamwana, who was up here in Anchorage briefly in December, and Lucy Makakula and Michael Gwaba from Zambia, who I spent a day or two with them, and all of them are alive, and their children have parents because of, for instance, the work of the Global Fund, and the success of the Global Fund in at least a small measure is due to that advocacy results in a number of countries, not just the U.S., but our sister results organizations in Great Britain, Canada, Australia, Germany, France, other donor nations. And to me, the amount of resources that we're talking about to save the lives of millions of people, it's just like a no-brainer. This is something that needs to be done. And if nobody else has taken up the cause, then I feel very privileged, you know, to be able to do that. If you go to the hard-hearted side of it, you know, you can make the argument even to some political official who doesn't consider himself to be a bleeding heart or herself, and you can point out, as Joanne said, that these diseases, if they're dealt with, countries are going to be more stable. The U.S. is going to be more secure. And talking to Don Young, I know he's commented on more than one occasion. He goes to Africa, you know, to get new trophies to hang on his wall. But he, in traveling in southern and eastern Africa, you know, it was very noticeable to him in the 90s and early 2000s that he'd go to a village and there was like just this big gap. There was a missing generation. There was a lot of little kids scampering around, and they were all being cared for by their grandmothers because their parents had all died of AIDS. That's, you know, a condition in the world that does not contribute long-term to U.S. security. If we can take a bite out of poverty or substantially alleviate it, the U.S., which is a big trading nation, is going to have more markets overseas. And for folks who are concerned about population and the environment, Results has worked for many years very successfully advocating on child survival. Between the early 80s and now, the amount of kids dying each day has gone down from over 40,000 to something well under 20,000 a day. And that change has helped in a demographic transition. Less kids are born. Parents choose to have less kids if they're sure that their kids are going to survive. So all across the board in all the major issues confronting the world, poverty and health need to be addressed. And if they're not, the U.S. is not a fortress. Infectious agents don't respect our national borders. And, you know, even if our concern is primarily for ourselves, self-interest dictates that we take interest in what's going on around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I asked the question, the way it came out of my mouth made me sound like I didn't have any understanding of the obvious altruistic and humanitarian aspects, which I do, but I was more trying to lead you guys to there is some self-serving there, is that the economies of the world are more and more interdependent, and if we can help more people be productive and innovative, they just increase the economic success of the whole world, which I think we also forget it goes on also in the United States. We need to address our own issues, and we'll all be better off for it. Is at least that's my understanding of what the evidence is.
And absolutely, and it hasn't come up in the conversation, but results is not exclusively focused on international stuff. We have a whole sister set of lobbyists who devote most of their attention to domestic poverty issues here in the U.S. That doesn't happen to be the main topic today or the focus of our Anchorage group now, but we would welcome somebody who wants to step up in Anchorage and start a global chapter, a domestic oriented chapter of our lobbying group.
And, you know, and to your point about just self-interest, I would say, again, just one really striking example, and I know that you're really aware of this as well, is just the issue of something like multidrug-resistant TB. So it's not just, TB is an airborne disease, but if you have a disease that, is much more deadly when it is drug-resistant, to a point where some strains, as we know, literally there's almost no drug that we have available to treat them, that much more toxic, much more deadly, and it can cost 100 times as much to treat. So if we don't actually make sure everybody takes their treatment, stop the spread of drug-resistant TB in the countries where that's happening, including in our own, but much more in other places around the world, then when one case comes here in the U.S., it can cost $1 million to treat and to treat all the people that have been exposed. And so we really are in a situation that we can pay modest amounts now and save lots of lives, or pay much more later, which with much more dire consequences. And that really is where self-interest and the sort of right thing to do come together.
And just to give a little plug for one of our elected representatives, Don Young has partly through the lobbying of Results volunteers here in the state, become something of a leader on the TB issue. He is actually the head Republican on a House Congressional TB Caucus, along with Congressman Engel of New York and Congressman Green from Texas. And that caucus was just started up a year or two ago with the goal of educating the other members of Congress so that the resources are made available. And Don has taken a lead on advocating with the appropriation subcommittees the need to devote adequate resources to supporting TB treatment in the developing world. And course, one of the topics here today is the Global Fund, and the Global Fund itself is the leading probably 70-80% of all the international funding that goes to support TB programs in developing countries and high-burden countries like India and sub-Saharan African countries. Most of those resources that aren't locally generated by the governments of those countries come through the Global Fund. So I want to give Don the credit for recognizing this important issue. It has a big history here in Alaska. We are still year after year in the top five. Every few years, if we have a little outbreak, we might have the highest TB rate of any state in the union. Fortunately, it's been a few years since we were number one, but we're always top 10. I want to acknowledge that some leadership is being provided here by our own elected representatives.
Dr. Carter, I kind of wanted to also talk a little bit more about the Global Fund so our listeners can understand exactly what that is. And it's my understanding that Results just sees that as one of the best places to put your efforts. And so I wanted to understand what it is you see about the Global Fund. Don's kind of, Roger's already kind of expressed a little bit about that, but I wondered if you could maybe fill in some of the blanks.
Sure. When we look at, so to your point, when we look at how, if these diseases are among the biggest killers, and we're looking for ways to tackle it, in Results, we really try to find what are the most effective, efficient mechanisms in the world that we can be investing in to have the biggest impact on these diseases. And that's really what brought us to be doing advocacy on the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. So the Global Fund was established by international leaders just a little over a decade ago. And really, in that short time, it's revolutionized the fight against these diseases. It finances treatment, prevention, and care for people. It's supported these programs in something like 150 countries. It supports governments, but also non-governmental groups and community groups in these countries to implement programs to fight these diseases. And we really do feel like it is the most effective mechanism that we've found. It's gone from 12 years ago just being created to now being the largest public health funder of these programs. And thanks to the work that it does, it's saving about 1 million lives every year through the funding that it provides to countries. And in a really good, smart way, it also leverages domestic funding. So it requires that if it's giving countries funding so that they can scale up treatment or prevention, use new kind of tools to fight these diseases, that they also actually have to invest domestic resources from their own countries to actually match that so it leverages funding. And the U.S. has played a really key role, providing about a third of the funding for the Global Fund. And just in December, the U.S. committed to provide a third of funding for the next 3 years for the Global Fund, about up to $5 billion.
All right. I think this is a good time to take our traditional kind of short one-minute break. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and then rejoin my guests, Dr. Joanne Carter and Roger Hudson, as we continue our discussion of efforts to control HIV, TB, and malaria throughout the world. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing efforts by the global advocacy organization Results and their efforts to help control HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. We've talked about the organization, an organization that they are involved with helping called the Global Fund. And why it is important for those of us in the United States to help with these efforts. If you've got questions or comments, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number 550-8433, and our toll free number 1-888-353-5752. We'll be here about another 25 or 26 minutes. You can also listen to this program again at KSKA between 9 and 10 this evening. However, that'll be a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Let's get back now. I think the best thing would be to talk about these particular illnesses. Maybe it doesn't need to be said, but why AIDS, HIV, TB, and malaria? Are those the principal causes of death that are affecting poverty around the world, or are there other reasons that these diseases are being singled out to be attacked?
These are certainly, AIDS, TB, and malaria are certainly three of the biggest killers around the planet. AIDS and TB often work together in deadly combinations, so people get immunosuppressed by AIDS, and then TB is one of the biggest killers of people who get the AIDS virus and become the HIV virus and become sick with it. So they're very interconnected, and they are among the biggest killers. And they were diseases that were having a huge impact, where we had strategies that we knew worked, but were not being taken to scale in the poorest countries in the world, and where we knew we could do a lot more. So that was really the genesis of the Global Fund, both the huge negative impact of these diseases and the opportunity that was not being seized by the world.
If you think back, I know you just had guests on in November, local folks who were involved with the AIDS care in the United States, and that was in anticipation of World AIDS Day, December 1st. And on World AIDS Day, there was some of the media replayed some of the old programs that were done, either fictionalized or reporting, relating back to the height of the AIDS crisis in the U.S. back in the 80s and the early 90s. And it really brought back to mind the stigma and, of course, in the early days, the lack of understanding of AIDS, its causes, and the lack of any available means to keep people healthy or to keep them from dying. And that kind of history in the U.S. of, overcoming denial and failure to focus on a major public health crisis is kind of repeated in the developing countries, a lot of them, even though in sub-Saharan Africa, at the same time AIDS was spreading in the United States, it was spreading much more broadly there and also in Southeast Asia. And it was not affecting as narrowly, for instance, in the U.S. there was a lot of identification with same-sex transmission, but in Africa, a lot of the disease was heterosexual transmission, and even now, women are disproportionately affected by HIV transmission in Africa. But what the difference was through the 90s was that as treatments became available, as the scientific medical community came up with some way to keep people from dying of HIV and damaged immune systems. In sub-Saharan Africa, both the countries and their governments and the international community were kind of just ignoring the problem. And as you got into the early 21st century, a little more than 10 years ago, there were tens of millions of infections in Africa, and there were like 50,000 people that were getting the drugs because of the cost factor, primarily, as well as, you know, a lack of willingness to have public discussion of the health crisis and acknowledge what was causing it, or even the understanding of it. You look at South Africa, which had the most cases. They had a president, Mbeki, who, you know, was kind of unconvinced that HIV was the cause of AIDS. But what happened in the early 2000s, both with the advent of the Global Fund and with the discovery of the issue and the embracing of it by President Bush, to his credit, starting in 2003, State of the Union message, he called on the U.S. to put a major amount of resources in combating AIDS. What we've had in the last decade, which coincides with the life of the Global Fund, is a growing commitment to make treatment available to poor people around the world. Mm-hmm. And we've gone from, you know, practically no one having access to treatment because it was just unaffordable, to having many millions of people on the drugs. In your website, you had a bunch of links coinciding with this program, and one of them was a little video about the Global Fund's accomplishments, and I noticed that it was the 2012 version, and 2013 just became available, summarizing the results up to that point. And according to that new little summary that's available on the Global Fund website, there's now 6 million people accessing antiretroviral treatment as a result of Global Fund programs, and that's 6 million people who, vast majority of them would probably be dead now or very soon if it wasn't for the Global Fund program. And of course, that is not just a raw number. That has impacts on their families, their children, their communities. So it's a huge positive impact that the Global Fund is having, and that's one of the reasons it results in taking that on as a special project or advocacy priority.
Let's. I have a phone call. It looks like it's about malaria, but I think we ought to let that person ask their question. It may give us a chance to move on to another little issue here. Ron, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you, Doctor. We actually used to be neighbors on Lord Baranoff. I am calling about the malaria matter, and I disagree very much with your host, not your host, but your call-in person's World Fund analysis. And my question is, I understand that approximately 10 million people die every year from malaria. My sister and her husband had it, still have it. And the question is, these people will now be saved if our best efforts work. Who is going to feed them? Who is going to feed their kids?
Okay. So one thing I would correct, and I'll ask Dr. Carter or Roger to correct, my information is about 660,000 people per year are dying of malaria. There are about 200 million episodes, not necessarily infections, because some of these infections recur in different people. So is that number right? And then what about the issue of now we got people living longer? Is that good or bad?
I think it's terrible for the environment. Whole parts of Africa that don't have any ability anymore to feed their populations.
Yeah. All right. Now, I was actually going to see what Dr. Carter and Roger had to say, but
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hang on. Let's see what
Thanks for your question and your concern. And I mean, we take it really seriously, and it's a really important one. So one on the number, Thad. The numbers that I know of, I have the same numbers that you do. It's sort of just under 1 million people die every year of malaria, and then, but hundreds of, several hundred million cases of it. But to the bigger question that your caller was asking about, which is, if people survive, how does that affect the planet and the population. I think it's one thing that's really, really important to understand is that UNICEF and others have looked at these issues for over 30 or 40 years, and what they have found is that, for example, most of the people that die of malaria are young children and pregnant women. That what they have found over and over and over is that when fewer, it doesn't necessarily seem like it makes sense, but it's actually the case that when families' children stop dying, they actually start to make decisions to have fewer children, and that we have never seen a decrease in population growth that wasn't preceded by a decrease in child deaths. So along with that, you need women to have access to family planning, and if women are educated and have economic opportunities, that makes a huge difference as well. But in fact, you've never seen population go down until kids stop dying. People have more kids because their children are dying. And so if we can take that combination of things, reducing child deaths, but also helping people have the tools to plan smaller families that they want, women to be educated, to marry later, all of those things, that's when we will see populations go down. And in fact, when we've seen also not just more kids dying, people have bigger families, but also when we've seen the destabilization of whole societies, we've actually seen, you know, worse situations for the planet as well as for communities than we've seen when families are stable, when they know breadwinners will survive, when kids are not dying. Roger, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Well, the one angle that I would pick up on is Ron was concerned that I think there was an implication in his question that developing countries, or the U.S. in particular, would have a responsibility for caring for and sustaining these people who didn't die of malaria. Actually, that's not predominantly the economic relationship between the U.S. or other wealthy countries, U.K., Scandinavia, Japan, what have you, in terms of the nutrition of people in the developing world. The people that are sick from malaria, they are suffering, and they may not be able to maintain their self-sufficiency and their household income if they didn't get sick because they were staying under a bed net, or the prevalence of malaria in the region where they lived, you know, was suppressed. Then they would be able, as every poor person is highly motivated, especially in many of these countries where there is effectively no safety net except your own family, to do everything they could to sustain themselves and earn their own living, so that the idea that a means of reducing demands upon wealthy country resources is to let, you know, more people become sick or some of them pass away in poorer regions of the world, the connection, I don't think, is really there. I think that those societies and their economies and at the household and community level will be greatly fortified by, you know, assisting them in getting public health issues under control.
The UN said that Nigeria in this century will head into the billions of people. You know, and Nigeria is no bigger than the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, there's no doubt that
whole parts of the ecosystem are being consumed because there's so many people. And of course, if you're born and you're alive, you want to eat. That's pretty basic. How are we going to feed them? You talk about structures and things of that nature. There is no structure there in some of those countries. There is no government. There's just warring factions.
I'm going to, Ron, we need to kind of move on. I think you're...
Yeah, your commentators blew it off. I didn't.
No,
but
no.
It's your time.
No, all right. Thank you, Ron. I was going to say that I think it is somewhat counterintuitive. And again, Roger, you and Dr. Carter, correct me, but I think there is absolutely no question that one of the biggest problems we're facing in the world is population. But that it's my understanding that one of the things that begins to get a control over population growth and being able to feed people is to raise the level of economy, and that one of the single best birth control methods is to have women educated. That's been shown repeatedly. And so that when you can get rid of these infectious diseases, educate the population, get the economies going, as contrary as it may seem, that is maybe a faster way to stop the growth than what we've been going through in the last 150 years. Your comments.
Well said. And I tried to say that earlier, but I don't know if it came across, because I think it's absolutely when women are educated, when women have a little bit more economic opportunity, they can make choices, and they will make choices to have smaller families. But I think the other thing that, again, is very counterintuitive, as you said, is that, again, and this is not me, it's not my opinion, it's the data from the last 30 or 40 years, that when kids stop dying, you don't actually see bigger population growth. You actually see lowered population, because people, women and families, can trust that their kids will survive. They start to plan to have fewer kids. And so it's really counterintuitive, but it's been shown over and over that you won't actually get reduced population until kids are surviving, until women are educated, and until obviously they have access to kind of effective family planning that they would choose to use.
Let's stay on a malaria issue just a second. I want the public to be able, and our listeners in particular, to hear a little bit about the treatment. Seems to be the principal primary use of the money that is available to control malaria? What's being done? What's the efforts? What's the strategy being used for malaria?
A lot of the strategy has actually been the scale up of prevention. Malaria is carried by mosquitoes. It's actually insecticide-treated bed nets. So it's bed nets that people sleep under that are treated with a relatively safe insecticide that's long-lasting, can last for a number of years. And the Global Fund, for example, has helped in the provision of something like 360 million insecticide-treated bed nets. And that's had, in just the last 3 or 4 years, a profound impact on reducing death due to malaria in like more than half a dozen countries in Africa. It's been cut by more than half in just the last few years. And then there's also treatment of malaria, so that when people get sick, making sure that we're using some of the newer, still relatively inexpensive, but newer drugs that actually work against malaria, that are the malaria parasite is not resistant to, and there have been over 300 million cases of malaria treated as well. Thanks, Global Fund.
I just happened to have pulled some stats off of the Global Fund website, and the pie chart for their expenditures on malaria shows that over half the money they have put into prevention, I would say prevention, you know, includes the bed nets. There may be some cautious use of insecticides as well, and there's a potential with malaria for kind of a virtuous circle, because there's three organisms involved. There's the malaria parasite, which lives within the mosquito and reproduces when the mosquito, you know, bites a person or another mammal. And to the extent that you get the amount of mosquitoes that are carrying that parasite down, and they're not reproducing because they're not getting access to people because they're protected by these insecticide-treated bed nets, then, even when the people come out from under the bed nets, they're, you know, it's probably a greater chance they'll be bitten by a mosquito who hasn't gotten involved with the parasite and so on, and over time the levels of prevalence of the disease, even in an area that still has a lot of mosquitoes, can be driven down. We do have good drugs. One of the things that was interesting that was on NPR last Friday on Morning Edition was a report, which I'm not sure the Global Fund has gotten into this, and I know Results hasn't done a lot of advocacy on it, but there's recent history work done on the ridding the southern U.S. of malaria, and the historians that were looking at it were giving a lot of the credit to draining wetlands that had a lot of mosquitoes. Now, that might be hard to do now in the U.S. with environmental laws and so on, protecting wetlands, but that was an interesting variation, because obviously, even with all the efforts been put in, there's still an awful lot of malaria in some areas of Africa and South Asia. But the one of the things that the Global Fund and Results advocates for is not only this external funding, but making these public health measures a priority for the governments of the countries where these diseases are still prevalent.
Dr. Carter, we've maybe got 7 minutes or so, not a lot of time left. And I want to also just briefly talk about tuberculosis. And since you're a veterinarian and have some of the medical background here, I'm going to call on you to help us put a face on tuberculosis and why we need to also know a little bit about this particular infection.
Yes, and really important, and you know, in the United States, maybe a little less in Alaska, people may be a little more aware of the disease. But I think in general, in the United States, people think of tuberculosis as something that was a disease of 50 or 100 years ago. You know, something that our grandparents died of, but that it's not really around anymore. But it's actually globally, it's the biggest curable infectious killer of adults on the planet. And it is a widespread bacteria. You know, one in every three people on the planet actually carries TB in their body. They're not sick from it, but they carry it around. And about 9 million people get sick with TB every year, and we're only reaching about two-thirds of them. So it's a huge problem. It mostly impacts, I mean, kids get sick as well, but it mostly impacts young adults, so the family breadwinners, you know, the parents. So, again, it's a big disease that pushes people into poverty. Remember, for your listeners, you know, HIV/AIDS, people don't die of HIV/AIDS. Their immune system gets suppressed and they die of other things. TB, tuberculosis, is actually the biggest killer of people with AIDS. And the disease is spread by coughing, sneezing. It's spread in the air. So we are all at risk of that disease. You know, we can treat TB. If you have basic tuberculosis, it can be treated and cured in poor countries for about $20 to $30 worth of drugs for a full six-month treatment. But you have to treat somebody, even for the most basic TB, right now for about 6 months. So it's really hard, right? We know how hard it is to stay on antibiotics for 10 days, never mind 6 months. And then for people, but if they do that, it's almost 100% curable. But if people don't take their medication or they get a drug-resistant strain from somebody else, it can take 2 years to treat it. Very toxic drugs and some strains that can't be treated at all. So we have a disease that is curable, and yet, you know, 9 million people still get sick every year. Over 1 million people die of it, but almost completely treatable and curable. And we have a really dangerous, growing epidemic of drug-resistant TB that is a huge threat to all of us that we need to get on top of as well. And that's really why the Global Fund is so important and why our support for these programs is so important domestically and internationally with things like the Global Fund. We can actually tackle this thing, but we actually do need to be aggressive and get ahead of the epidemic, or guarantee the epidemic will get ahead of us.
We've only got a couple more minutes, but when you sit and think about this, and I, as we're listening to this, I'm thinking about it. It's a circular issue. If you have poverty, you're at increased risk. But if you've also if you're in poverty, you know, you're more likely to get these particular problems, and you have less and less opportunity to treat it. You have the cost issues. You have distance. You have availability. So it's a complex issue, but as you're stating, and I think what I've heard is that we are definitely making some impact, and because of the financial help of not only the United States but other countries and the scientific advancements, we're at a point where we can really come close to, and I hate to use the word eradicate because it's very difficult to do that, but really get much, much better control over these illnesses, and as a consequence, raise the economic benefit to the whole economic benefit of the world.
I mean, you said it beautifully. I mean, we're at a pivot point. Like, we actually are at a point, if maybe not eradicate, but literally defeat these diseases as major public health issues in the next 10 to 15 years. Again, if we invest not huge amounts of money, but a little bit aggressively now, if we build on what we've done the last 10 to 15 years that we should be incredibly proud of, we can actually come close to defeating these diseases in the next 10 to 15 years, and that will have huge economic payoffs, even in just the direct cost that we're all paying for these things, but also, as you said, in the sort of broader economic and social benefits, the new markets, the partnerships, the, you know, and all of that is really very close. But I think the other thing to just think about is the window that we have to do this will not be open forever, and that if we don't seize on this, the epidemics will get ahead of us, and then we may not have this opportunity again, you know, meaning millions more deaths, much more costly to get this under control eventually, or maybe losing the ability to do that at all.
Roger, we got about a minute. You got some final words of wisdom for us?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. What I would like to encourage any of your listeners that are interested to do is look at the resources that you put up online. Go to the results website, results.org, www.results.org. It has a link to locate local volunteers in any community where they exist. You can contact me and other people in the results group here in Anchorage. My email is ANCH, first four letters of the city, results, ANCResults@msn.com. My cell number is 570-2979. I'd love to hear from people, talk about them, including your caller who, you know, had reservations about some of these efforts, and discuss the issues and try and interest people in exercising their citizenship. It's fun, you meet great people, and you can really have an impact on the world.
Well, listen, thanks very much to both of you. Joanne, thanks for joining us early in the evening back there in Washington.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
All right, Roger, thanks for you too.
Thanks very much.
My thanks again to Dr. Joanne Carter and Roger Hudson. If you want to continue this discussion, you can find the link to KSK on and Facebook on our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to address antibiotic overuse and bacterial resistance to antibiotics with Dr. Michael Bell of the CDC. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, January 13th from 2 to 3 p.m. Remember, we repeat each Monday evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and helped today by engineering. Thanks for listening and have a great day. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.